Writer Salman Rushdie is known for fusing fantasy with the real world. For our book series, You Must Read This, he recommends a book that inventively sums up the history of the universe in a dozen stories.
I first read Cosmic Comics by the great Italian writer Italo Calvino in my early 20s, and it's a book I've gone back to again and again. In 1965, Italo Calvino took on as a subject nothing less than the creation of the universe. In a light, fantastic collection of 12 short stories titled Cosmic Comics, possibly the most enjoyable story collection ever written, a book that will frequently make you laugh out loud at its mischievous mastery, capricious ingenuity, and nerve. According to Calvino, in the story The Distance of the moon was once so close to the Earth that lovers could jump across to it, and, literally moonstruck, could tryst and dally on the shining satellite, which was, by the way, dripping with moon milk, a kind of cream cheese. Then the moon started moving away, and lovers had to choose whether to return to Earth or remain trapped in the land of love. In my favorite story, All at One Point, the Big Bang turns out to be the result of the first generous impulse. Before the bang, in pre-time and pre-space, things were pretty crowded. In reality, there wasn't even space to pack us into. Every point of each of us coincided with every point of each of the others in a single point, which is where we all were. Then a being named Mrs. Finco, the prototypical Italian mama, cried out, "Oh, if I only had some room, how I'd like to make some noodles for you boys." And at once, wham, there was room. Perhaps only Italo Calvino could have created a work that combines scientific erudition, wild fantasy, and a humane wit that prevents the edifices of these stories from toppling into whimsy. If you've never read Cosmic Comics, you have before you 12 of the most joyful reading experiences of your life.
Salman Rushdie is the author of many books, including his latest, The Enchantress of Florence. The book he recommends is Cosmic Comics by Italo Calvino. For the entire list of You Must Read This recommendations, please go to our website at npr.org.
Marilynne Robinson, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Gilead, has been called the moralist of the Midwest, but that's not a title she would embrace. Though her books are imbued with an old-fashioned ethic, Miss Robinson is uncomfortable with too much talk about morality. She says that word can easily be misused. NPR's Lynn Neary recently visited Marilynne Robinson in Iowa, the setting for both Gilead and Miss Robinson's new book, Home.
When Marilynne Robinson decided to take a job teaching at the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop, she thought her stay would be temporary. But something about the rolling fields and small towns that are sprinkled throughout the Iowa countryside got to Robinson, and the 2 years she first committed to are now heading toward 20. Housekeeping, the book that brought Robinson literary fame, was set in Idaho, where she grew up. But Gilead and Home are both grounded in the heartland that is Iowa. Robinson says the fictional Gilead that is the setting for both books was inspired by the town she has visited over the years. On a rainy, late summer day, Robinson strolled through one such town, West Branch, which also happens to be the birthplace of Herbert Hoover.
See, there's the birthplace. Look at that house.
This one right here?
No, the little white building down there.
A little tiny one.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
West Branch is partly a restored village and partly a typical small town, its main street lined with old-fashioned storefronts and simple white clapboard homes. It is, says Robinson, a town not unlike Gilead.
Well, there's a definite Iowa aesthetic. It's kind of hard to describe. It's very, it's sort of modest and optimistic.
We slip into an old Quaker meeting house to get out of the rain, and Robinson immediately seems comfortable in the silence of the place.
It just seems as if silence has been absorbed into the walls here. It's more silent than normal silence, you know. It's very moving, I think.
Robinson is not someone who needs to fill a silence, any more than she is a writer who needs to fill a page with unnecessary words. Perhaps that is why she has felt pulled so strongly to the quieter rhythms of small towns.
I think people forget in the metropolitan parts of the country that the country really is largely made up of small towns that function well for the most part and that people are very devoted to.
Why did you call the town Gilead?
Well, Gilead is a kind of characteristic early 19th century name for towns in America, partly because people had these utopian intentions, you know, and they were going to create the place where there was balm, where the pain of other civilization would be answered, you know. And I looked on a map, and Iowa did not have a Gilead, so I sort of gave it one.
The biblical overtones inherent in the name Gilead are no accident. Robinson's writing is strongly influenced by her own faith. Raised a Presbyterian, she got interested in Congregationalists while studying about 19th century American writers in college. Now, she's a longtime member of the Congregational United Church of Christ in Iowa City.
This is the oldest church still in use in Iowa City.
It's a beautiful church.
Very fond of it.
Sitting in a wooden pew in the sanctuary of the church, Robinson talks about her faith, her writing, and how they intersect. At one point, Robinson refers to herself as a Christian writer, then qualifies what she means by that.
I wouldn't necessarily start out to write books that are, you know, quote-unquote Christian in the sense that they wouldn't be meaningful to any other category of people, but at the same time, I don't think there's any mystery about the fact that when I draw on my own deeper resources, this interest of mine certainly emerges.
Two ministers, Reverend John Ames and Reverend Robert Boughton, play a central role in both Gilead and home. Best friends since childhood, both are now close to death. Robinson's own pastor, Bill Lovin, says he was moved by her portrayal of these men.
It touched me, I think, as a minister, because I think in so many ways she got being a minister right.
Both books tell the story of a prodigal son from different perspectives. Jack Boughton returns home as an adult in need of redemption after a life tainted with failure and regret. Gilead begins the story from the point of view of Reverend Ames. Robinson delves into the story more deeply in Home as a dying Reverend Boughton tries to come to terms with the pain Jack has caused his family. Both Robinson and Pastor Lovin agree the parable of the prodigal son is a powerful one.
It's about love. You know, it's about the fact that love is not earned and love is not felt in anyone at their will because they have made some calculation of someone's worth. That's one of Jesus' most radical parables because it completely overturns all notions of deserving, all notions of how you are scoring relative to other people in life.
You know, with the story in Home, then it's really that sense of, you know, what happens after the prodigal son does come home? You know, after people are glad to see him, then what?
And this is so much a story of someone seeking forgiveness and not really getting it.
I don't think it's really forgiveness that he's looking for. I think he knows that his father forgives him to the degree that his father's capable of forgiving him. I mean, behind the failure to forgive that you can sense in Boughton is a much stronger desire to forgive, which I consider forgiveness.
Robinson says she loves to explore theological questions in her writing, but she does not need, nor does she set out to find, the answers to such questions. She is content to ponder the mysteries of faith from her quiet perch in the heartland. Lynn Neary, NPR News.
And you can read an excerpt from and a review of Home at our website, npr.org.
Poet and author E. Ethelbert Miller has been writing about baseball lately. He's just completed his second memoir, The Fifth Inning. Ethelbert Miller chairs the board of the Institute for Policy Studies and is director of the African American Resources Center at Howard University. Welcome back, Ethelbert.
Oh, it's always good to see you.
Your memoir, you call it The Fifth Inning. Would you start off by reading the passage that begins, "In the Fifth Inning"?
In the fifth inning, you know anything can happen. This could be a complete game. You count your blessings for surviving the fourth. The first hitter sends a ball deep to the warning track in left field. This brings your manager to his feet. He starts to pace in the dugout. He's afraid you're losing it. You look down at your feet and kick the rubber. You're afraid, too, and it tips the next hitter off. One swing and you're down four. The next two hitters follow with a single and a double. It's over now. You might as well play catch in the backyard with the kids. The catcher asks the umpire for time and walks out to the mound. Here comes your manager getting ready to ask for the ball. Inside your glove, you hold it and keep waiting for it to speak. The silence tells its own story. The game keeps searching for an author.
Fifth inning. You're nearing the end of your 50s.
Right.
Why does the baseball metaphor work for you in this memoir?
Well, I went back to what people say, write about what you know. And I realized that one thing I knew was baseball. And it was something I enjoyed growing up in the South Bronx in the shadows of Yankee Stadium, standing and getting autographs from people like Jim Boughton, you know, and Hector Lopez and Mickey Mantle. And so I went back to that. But what triggered it was the fact that I was losing so many friends who were not making it through their 50s, who weren't making it through that complete game.
You also write, the memoir writer has to decide what secrets not to tell. You hint at some of your own secrets. You stopped drinking. What secrets were okay for you to tell?
Well, I think, you know, sometimes what happens, you ask yourself in your life, what secret am I willing to reveal at this particular point? And will it help someone? Something that you kept to yourself that now you feel, if I share this, this might help somebody in their life.
I can't help thinking of baseball. I mean, because every player has their statistics and their probabilities.
And their superstitions.
And their superstitions. And there are some you tell and some...
You don't.
You don't.
That's why it's a short book.
Baseball is also about magical stories. There's always two outs. It's the bottom of the ninth. You know, the count is 3-2. And
right.
Comes that last pitch and boom,
right.
Magic happens.
I mean, I will always go back to Bill Mazeroski, you know, hitting the home run in the World Series, Pirates against the Yankees.
You recall, imagine you were playing for the Yankees. I'd like you to read actually that passage.
I think all memoirs should consist of magical stories. How often did I imagine myself playing for the Yankees when I was a child? It was I, not Mickey Mantle, who hit the home run in the bottom of the ninth. We didn't call it a walk-off home run back then. We didn't stand in the batter's box like Reggie Jackson or Manny looking at our artwork. We didn't cast our bats aside like fishing rods or spears. No, there was no posturing or television highlight. We played the game not like entertainers, but like workers putting in a good day's work. We played with our backs hurting and our hands bruised. We played with our bad knees and sore muscles. Some of us were Iron Men, and others were simply legends.
Mm. I think about all those pitchers that are made it to their 40s, you know, and are still
right.
Pitching
right.
Really well.
And knowing how to pitch and not just throw.
Yeah. Did you think then that you would make it to the fifth inning?
I don't know, because, you know, my brother died, you know, in his 40s. And when you lose a person in your family who you thought would live forever, it wakes you up. And so I don't take things for granted.
How many more innings you want to play?
I want to play a few extra innings.
Yeah. You want to go into overtime?
I want to go into overtime, huh. Right.
How many do you think you will be able to play?
Well, you know, that depends on, you know, I look at my mother next year, she'll be 90. I look at friends of mine who have been married, you know, for X number of years, and I wonder whether they can pass Joe DiMaggio's 56 straight games. You know, I mean, I look at baseball, I look at life, and you're blessed, you know, from one pitch to the next.
E. Ethelbert Miller chairs the board of the Institute for Policy Studies and is director of the African American Resources Center at Howard University. Great to see you again. Thanks
oh,
for coming
it's always
in.
Good to see you. Thank you.
We now turn to The Infinitely Improbable. If you haven't heard of the book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, here's how it starts. A regular British guy named Arthur Dent is whisked away from planet Earth by a friend he doesn't know is an alien just before the planet is demolished to make way for a hyperspace bypass. It only gets weirder from there. The author, Douglas Adams, died of a heart attack in 2001. But next October, book publisher Hyperion plans to release a sixth installment of The Hitchhiker's Guide, written by someone else. That someone else? Owen Colfer. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Andrea.
Your series, the Artemis Fowl books, are loved by millions of teenagers, your own fans. Why would you pick up someone else's books?
This was like a bolt from the blue for me. I had no intention of continuing anyone else. I mean, I've got a good thing going here. Why would I want to upset the apple cart? But the more I thought about the offer, the more intrigued I became. And I thought, well, I could take 8 months out of my life to write this. And if I don't, and someone else writes it, and I hate it, then I will always regret it.
I have to say, I am a huge, huge, huge Douglas Adams fan myself.
It's the third huge that worries me. First two huges, that's fine.
But I have to say, I mean, my first reaction is, why would you do this?
That's my first. But listen, this is not like Madonna redoing a Don McLean song. It's not like that. I'm not going to touch the first five books. I'm going to just do another story. So if you don't like it, it won't affect your love of the first five books. That's how I'm rationalizing it to myself.
Do you have anything to go on from Douglas Adams himself? Notes, original thoughts?
Well, I am good at channeling spirits, so when I go home today, I'm going to lie on my back in a quiet room and see if I can contact him and see what he says. But I don't really. I think that's probably for the best. I'm not going to try and write like Douglas, because I don't think anyone could. I'm just going to take his characters and write in my own style, and hopefully the amount of people who like it will be more than the amount of people who don't like it.
What can we expect from this, though?
Well, I don't want to give too much of the plot away, but obviously at the end of the fifth book, all the characters were left for dead. So for the sixth book to work, I have to somehow get them from their place of certain death in London and help them to avoid that. And from there, once they're all reunited, then bring them off on another adventure.
Owen Colfer, what would you think if, after your death, someone else came along and wrote an Artemis Fowl book?
That's interesting. I wouldn't like someone to do it when I was alive. I think that would be a little bit of a liberty. That would be, you know, hello. But if when I died, if it was someone good, I think it would only reflect well on me that someone would want to continue the series. But what the question is, is this going to be good or is it going to be junk? And if it's a good book, everything will be forgiven. If it's a bad book, then I deserve to be pilloried by this galaxy and all other parallel ones.
Owen Colfer is the author of the popular teen sci-fi fantasy series Artemis Fowl. He's working on a sixth book in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series.
Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen were a duo when most of America was divided. They became a comedy team in Chicago in the late 1960s, a black man and a white man, making jokes at a time of riots, bloodletting, and bruised feelings in America. Here's a routine in which Tom asked Tim for lessons in how to act black.
I tell you, let's see you walk like a brother. Yeah, let's walk.
Walk like a brother?
Walk like a black man.
Watch me.
My man.
Zippity-doo-dah.
Tim and Tom toured the country, staying popular in Chicago, drawing laughs in New York, New Orleans, and many other places. But their failure to burst through to the top rungs of comedy often frustrated their working relationship. Each had to go on to very successful solo careers. Tom Dreesen became one of America's premier stand-up comics, longtime opening act for Frank Sinatra. And Tim Reed became an actor and producer who created the honored series Frank's Place, which is probably still recognized almost everywhere in the world today as Venus Flytrap on WKRP in Cincinnati. They've written a book with our old friend Ron Rappaport about their breakthrough on stage and in the life of this country. It's called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen join us from Chicago. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
You know, we usually ask newlyweds this question, but let's try it on you. How did you meet?
Well, it was on eharmony.com. We actually met in Harvey, Illinois. Tim had graduated from Norfolk State College. E.I. DuPont recruited him into Chicago as a marketing rep. He joined the JCs. We worked together on a drug education program. It became very successful, teaching elementary school children the ills of drug abuse through humor. And one day a little girl said, "You guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team."
We're going to change.
We're going to change now. You got a French Riviera apartment.
Oh, yeah?
In Harlem, overlooking the Apollo Theater. One of them high-rise units. Two floors.
I'm way up there.
One day you come outside your high-rise. You open the door, you see the whole neighborhood's been integrated by the National Guard. It's a riot.
A riot?
That's right.
I can't go down there.
What do you mean?
I've got a heart murmur. My heart keeps murmuring. Don't go down there, Whitey.
Tell me about playing a polka club, because that's not a place that you would often turn up, Mr. Reed.
Not on the northwest side of Chicago at that time. When Tom told me where we were appearing that night, I looked at him like he was crazy.
So on the way down there, I said, "Tim, here's what we do. We tell them we're sorry we're a little bit late, but we stopped on the south side for soul food. And then I wrote these words down, and Tim memorized them. Tim went up on stage, and he said, I'm sorry we're late. We stopped on the south side for soul food. And all those Polish people looked at him. He said, Chinina, gołąbki, kabasa, pierogi. And then they broke into huge laughter. And then we had him in the palm of our hands.
Yes, indeed.
Were you aware of doing something important, or were you just trying to make people laugh?
You had to be aware that when you're a black and white man and you walk out on stage, that it's certainly dangerous and it's certainly a bit unusual. The country was going through tremendous chaos. In addition to race problems, the Vietnam demonstrations and protests. So when we walked out there, there was always that 20, 30 seconds of people sitting there going, oh my God, what's going to happen? And we always, no matter whether we were doing racial or non-racial material, we always had to be in context of the audience, and it was always racial because of the times. Today, the funniest black and white comedy team is, of course, Obama and McCain, but back then, we were the only ones.
It's funny. It weighs an illustrative set piece of that. You've got an anecdote in your book where you demonstrate that funny lines are not interchangeable. Context depends on who says them and the color of
yes.
someone.
Yeah. We were working a club in Detroit, tough neighborhood, black club. Tom said, why don't we walk out there next time if somebody heckles us, because we got heckled a lot. He said, I'll step up and say, hey, don't bother him. He's mine. You know how hard they are to train. And I said, no, Tom, you can't do that. That's going to be offensive. And we govern each other that way. So that night we went before this crowd, all black audience, and some black guy in the back stood up and started heckling Tom. And I said, hold up, brother. Get your own. He's mine. You know how hard they are to train. And the audience went crazy.
Every comic gets hecklers. But the heckling that you two gentlemen faced down was sometimes more serious.
Life-threatening. Back then, comedy was a blood sport, and we shared a lot of blood in certain places. One night, one of the first times we had a performance, I guess, in a paying gig.
In Chicago Heights, Illinois, it was our fourth time ever on stage, and a guy put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face and then proceeded to try to beat me half to death.
Something that just really pierced my heart, remark you make in the book, Mr. Reed, is that Tom Dreesen wasn't just your first white friend. He was really your only close friend.
You know, I came from an all-segregated community, all-segregated education from elementary school all the way up to college. I didn't have any social contact with white America. And it's hard to explain to people the context of race then and now. Mm-hmm. There was no dialogue. We were the dialogue at that time for race relations.
When Tim and I went on stage in those days, we were the discourse they either wished they had or should have been having. And we didn't always talk about race. We had routines about if we were just talking about hamburgers, but we were a black guy and a white guy talking about hamburgers, and we were on stage having a lot of fun together.
You always get to play the black guy.
You want to run that by me again?
Just once, I'd like to play the black guy.
I totally have the rib sauce, man.
I really think I could be a black guy. I mean, I've been traveling with you for a long time. I gotta tell you the truth, I like the way the brothers walk.
Yeah?
I mean, I like the way the brothers talk.
Yeah?
I like the way they dress, the smooth style they have. You know, the way they're always referring to their mom. You know, mother this and...
I forgot those routines.
Yes,
you know that?
Yeah. I've heard that in a long while. When we were on and when it worked, it was not only incredible fun, but the people really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I guess it was a freedom to be able to laugh at race at that time and not feel not only threatened, but not feel embarrassed by it.
Why, after a few years, couldn't you work together anymore?
From my point of view, it was primarily financial. I mean, we were not making any money. We were struggling, and I just did not have the faith that Tom had that something was going to change. And I just said, you know, I'm starving. I got a family. I've quit my job. I've got to survive. I come from poverty, and I'm allergic to poverty. So I decided that it would be best for me and my family if I went on my own.
And I never wanted the act to break up, to be honest with you. I thought Tim and Tom were going to become the most significant comedy team the nation had ever known. And that was my dream, my hope. I had never been on stage before in my life until I met Tim Reed. So everything I envisioned for our future success was Tim and I. So when the team broke up, like Tim, I had a wife and three kids. He had a wife and two kids. I mean, I was on my rear end, and it broke my heart.
And the irony of it is Tom not only made it first, but he went from living in a car to working with Sammy Davis in about 2 hours. I mean, it was just amazing.
Well, and got on The Tonight Show.
And got on Tonight Show, and I watched him that night. I was in bed and hadn't worked in a long time, broke. Things were not looking very good for me. And I'm watching him, and he, as they say in our business, killed. And I sat there, and I had the strangest emotions I've ever had in the same instance. I was very happy for him, and I was extremely sad for myself. It was a feeling I hope to never have again.
And Mr. Reed, of course, as we mentioned, there's probably not an hour of the day that doesn't go by that you're not Venus Flytrap and one rerun or another of WKRP. Mm-hmm. And you've produced and directed a lot. You are responsible for a show that is really spoken of with such reverence in television history, Frank's Place.
Yeah.
About a man who owned a nightclub or a bar in New Orleans.
Have you ever owned a restaurant?
What, do you think I'm nuts? I'm a consultant, Frank. You could take my advice or leave it. You pay me to consult, I'm consulting.
Okay.
First thing you gotta do, get some night business in here fast.
How am I gonna do that?
All right.
My regulars are working people. They don't come out very much during the week. And the white folks don't come down here during the night.
You can fix that.
I can.
Advertising flyers in all the hotels produces new customers. Cab drivers, $5 for every carload they deliver. Valet parking. Whitey walks from his car to your door, safe enough.
I was almost shocked to read in the book for all the reputation that show has, it just ran a season.
Yeah, it did only run a season. One of the major regrets I have is that that show did not go for at least 3 to 4 years. I think had it gone for 3 or 4 years, we probably would have had a lot to do with changing the attitudes within the business about race and how it's portrayed in television.
Looking back on it, what do you think you learned from each other?
Oh, the trusting in someone else. I mean, no one really makes it alone. I certainly would not be in this business were it not for Tom and vice versa. And in the end, what's missing today, not only in show business, but I think in politics and everything, is passion. Most people really don't like what they're doing. We really had passion for what we were about.
Yeah, that's what I think I learned from Tim, what I learned also in the service, too, that when two people go through hardships, they bond. Tim watched my back many nights in a lot of ways, and I watched his back. It never had anything to do about race with us, never. We were just two buddies. And boy, I'll tell you, when the crisis hits, if you got a pal there with you, it sure helps.
Gentlemen, great pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Tim Reed, Tom Dreesen, their new book with our friend Ron Rappaport, Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.